From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. No one knows what the future holds, but we can imagine. My guest tonight is looking forward just 11 years and painting a picture of an all-too-plausibly diminished America that will shock you and maybe wake up the country tonight on Point. Future shock, imagining life in America in 2016 as you hope it will never be. But first, we begin tonight with reaction to General Motors' announcement today of major looming cutbacks. Here's Chairman Rick Wagoner at GM's annual shareholders meeting in Wilmington, Delaware, this morning.
We expect to close additional assembly and component plants over the next few years and to reduce our manufacturing employment levels in the U.S. by 25,000 or more people in the 2005 to 2008 period.
25,000 jobs to be cut in 3 years. That has turned heads today, but it is no surprise that GM is in trouble. Jamie Butters is automotive and business writer for the Detroit Free Press. He joins me now. Jamie, thanks for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
So give us the backdrop here. Clearly, Rick Wagoner feels pressure to do something significant quickly. What's the gun at GM's head?
You know, I just want to say, I mean, I think that he's under a lot of pressure to announce something severe quickly. You know, this is 25,000 jobs over 4 years. It's not much more than they cut the previous 4 years, which were some of the best years that GM has had in a long time.
So you're saying it looks like a big number, but in fact it's not yet. Wall Street reacted fairly positively today. Does the Street want deeper cuts, bigger, faster?
Yeah, I think they probably were glad to hear some recognition of the problem, and GM has been talking lately about trying to kind of sell their way out of their problems, and they kind of get into their problems by selling their way into them. So this seems like a more realistic recognition of the fact that their market share has eroded significantly, and they need to bring their ability to make cars and trucks down to their ability to sell them.
Still, doesn't ending up with a workforce 25,000 smaller in 3 or 4 years mean that GM is planning to cut back significantly?
Yeah, they are, and they have been, and they will continue. Actually, a friend of my colleague Jeffrey McCracken did some number crunching today. You know, to meet this goal, they'll have to cut on average 6,250 jobs each year. The previous 4 years, they cut an average of 5,500 each year, and from 91 to 97, they averaged 9,000 job cuts a year.
Wow.
Now, of course, this is getting onto a smaller base, and it will be more dramatic, but they have a lot of people who are close to retirement. It's going to be some plants. They've got a lot more competition from Toyota, from Honda, from Nissan, from Hyundai even now, just opened a plant in Alabama last month. And GM is not going to have the kind of dominance of the U.S. market that it once did.
Does this look like a viable survival plan, even if it will be a smaller, less dominant GM?
That's the real question, isn't it? You know, they have so many retirees whose pensions and health care they're supporting with this ever-shrinking current employee base. You know, GM averages about 2.5 retirees for every active worker in the United States. You know, Ford is at 1.2 retirees, and it's a real burden for them, and they really need to come out with great cars and trucks that people are willing to buy.
What about that on the product side? Did Rick Wagoner give a strategy there today? Clearly, SUVs aren't going to sell as well in high gas price times, so what's GM got up its sleeve on the car and truck side?
Boy, I wish I knew. You know, they've been talking about the need for great products. That sounds good. That makes good sense. But everybody's doing that. Everybody's trying to come out with great products. And their timing is really unfortunate in that what they have coming that's new and exciting for the next year is big SUVs and big pickup trucks. And, you know, the outlook for those highly profitable segments is looking significantly less profitable and less robust in the coming year or two. It's a real challenge for them. They intend to bring out more of the crossover models that are built like cars, but they have more of the functionality of a SUV or a pickup. Mm. But you know, they're late to the game on that, and it's going to be a real challenge for them.
So they're talking about cutting back 1/6 of their workforce in the next 3 or 4 years. Does anyone think, Jamie, that that will be the end of it, or is there an expectation that GM may just keep on shrinking?
No, I don't think anyone thinks that'll be the end of it. You know, if they It could be. But it doesn't seem very likely. They still have a lot of retirees. They will still have a lot of retirees. If they can come out with these, if their new products do really great, they can stop shrinking. that would be a great achievement for General Motors at this point.
Well, we will be watching, but tough stuff ahead, it sounds like. Jamie Butters, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
You bet, anytime.
Jamie Butters covers the automotive industry for the Detroit Free Press. He spoke with me from Detroit. Pick up a paper, turn on the radio or TV, and you're bound to come across a story about any number of ominous economic trends facing America. Massive deficits, a fragile dollar, a housing bubble, lost jobs, scarce oil. But try imagining a chain of events where bad news in any of these soft spots sparks a tumble in the next, where the sum of all those worrisome weaknesses brings the whole American economy tumbling down and your lifestyle with it. Not over the course of a century or even a few decades, but in the next 10 or 11 years. Tonight, we're looking back from the year 2016 with Atlantic Monthly writer James Fallows at an imagined and all too plausible meltdown, at an America reduced in the blink of an eye to second-class status, at Americans living second-class lives. You can join the conversation. Are you assuming that America's standard of living and place in the world will always be what they are today? Can you imagine waking up 11 years from now in a second-class nation on the ropes, a has-been? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is James Fallows, national writer for the Atlantic Monthly. His piece in the upcoming edition is headlined Countdown to a Meltdown, America's Coming Economic Crisis, a look back from the election of 2016. James Fallows, good to have you. Thanks for joining us today.
Tom, thank you.
So here you are painting a picture to make our eyes pop out. And the conceit here is that, The authorial voice is an advisor to a presidential candidate in January of 2016, a third-party candidate, not Republican or Democrat, who looks certain to win the upcoming election, and he's filling him in on how the United States got into such a terrible bind. Have I got that right?
Yes. This is from whoever is the Karl Rove of that election, a couple of elections from now, to whoever's going to be the first non-Democrat, non-Republican since before the Civil War, somebody whose victory is just about guaranteed if they don't screw up the campaign. And this is the master strategy memo saying, here's how to understand the predicament we got in, because once we win, it's going to be like FDR in 1933. You have a lot to fix at once.
How bad is the situation that this imagined candidate, soon-to-be winner, is facing in 2016?
Well, the situation is, and one word of background, you know, my intention with this article, obviously, is not to make everybody emigrate to New Zealand or whatever, but just to extrapolate quite logically from all the trends underway now. And the situation, well, for example, General Motors isn't a problem anymore with its unemployment, with its employment base, because 4 years earlier in 2012, it and Ford were both acquired by Toyota, which is already the biggest auto company in the world. And the reason is that the poor American car companies had, you know, even now been losing money on every car they sold, separate from trucks and SUVs. And as the price of oil skyrocketed, for reasons we can get into later, they you know, just were brought under. So that was just an extrapolation of the current situation. There have been repossession riots throughout many of the fast-growing real estate areas.
Repossession riots around foreclosures on people's homes in your imagined scenario.
Yes. Again, if you combine the effects of a real estate bubble with a currency run on the U.S. currency for other reasons we can get into, the areas where real estate had been hottest and people had been bidding up prices the most and taking these interest-only loans, when suddenly the interest rate goes up very quickly and that $500,000 house becomes a $300,000 house and $1 million house becomes a $600,000 house, suddenly people can't meet the payments anymore. And if it were a normal economic good, what people would do is just, you know, give it back to the bank and declare bankruptcy.
But it's their home.
kids their home, and so they behave the way they did in the Great Depression, which is to stay there and wait for the bank to evict them.
You paint this amazing picture of the government trying to kill two birds with one stone, selling subsidized RVs, recreational vehicles, to all these Americans who have been kicked out of their homes, opening up army bases where kind of shanty towns on wheels gather. These are dispossessed Americans roaming the country like Okies in the Dust Bowl, from the Dust Bowl.
Well, you could think of this as a Clinton-esque third way of trying to find a kind of reasonable compromise. And I described the security in shelter summit that was held at the White House, where you have all these people, often sort of yuppie people, being evicted. You do have, of course, all these decommissioned air bases and military bases, and the factories in Detroit need something to keep them going. So there is a kind of package deal to have subsidized. If the people will agree to leave their houses without being forcibly evicted, they can have subsidized RVs and spaces on the military bases.
James Fallows, we're going to look at a lot more details of your imagined 2016 scenario, but bottom line, and we'll look at the reasons why, but bottom line, is this a plausible scenario? We hear all this news, it all goes floating by, but could it add up to this seriously, acutely, viscerally diminished America that soon?
I think that not everything I describe in this article is exactly going to come to pass. For example, the conversion of the Harvard campus to the historic site of the Harvard campus with its headquarters overseas. But if you were, the only thing that would keep it from happening is changing the fundamentals now, because all the fundamentals of currency policy, trade policy, federal budget policy would leave in this direction if we don't do something.
And you're saying it could happen, and it could happen in the next 11 years. We're going to come back and fill out this picture. James Fallows has painted, it's a great big mural of what America might look like in 2016, an imagined vision of America when oil, the dollar, the deficit, jobs, interest rates have all gone horribly and all too realistically wrong. It could happen, he says. You can join the conversation tonight. Are you assuming that America's standard of living and standing in the world will always be what they are today? Do you live every day presuming that the country's debt and deficits and lost industries will never come back to bite it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are looking back on America from the year 2016 tonight, on a shockingly rough road ahead for the American economy and American people, as envisioned by James Fallows in the upcoming issue of the Atlantic Monthly magazine. He's got a very scary scenario of very real economic collapse laid out in an imagined memo to a presidential candidate in the year 2016. It's everything you pray won't happen, but easily could. The United States tumbling into second-tier economic status that feels for many like the Great Depression. You can join us tonight. What if the world calls America's bluff? What if the cards come tumbling down? Would the train wreck look like the America James Fallows describes? And how high is the risk? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jim Fallows, you've got some special creds with us here. We had you on a couple of years and change ago when you were talking about a piece you had written describing Iraq as the coming 51st state, the kind of you break it, you own it notion of Colin Powell. You said if the United States owns Iraq, it's going to have a big, huge problem on its hands for many years, and that has emerged as pretty much what it looks like. So we're listening to you with special care tonight. I guess you've earned it in that analysis of Iraq and much else. I wish you'd just give us some more of these pieces that will fill in the picture of what you see in 2016. For example, local governments, state governments, absolutely starved for funds and turning everything into fee-for-service. You call 911, you pay.
Right. Well, the big thing that makes life unfair if you're a mayor, a state legislator, or a governor is that while the federal government can run up these gigantic deficits, and that's one of the prime movers for this whole scenario that I'm describing, most states can't do that. The majority of states have some kind of limitation, most municipalities too, that they can't deficit spend very long. And so when all the things that affect federal government spending, you know, falling incomes, falling real estate values, rising prices for security, rising prices for energy, when they affect the local governments, they have no choice. And you've begun to see, again, it's just an acceleration of what we've seen over the last 10 years or so with education, where there's more and more of parents having to pick up the cost, not just for higher education, but for K-12 too, and beginning in some kind of municipalities with special security fees. you can imagine pretty much everything being converted to fee-for-service by a decade from now, because what alternative do the states and localities have?
Of course, that means you only get the service if you have the cash to pay for it. Many people don't. You described a picture where half the country's households live on $50,000 a year or less at a time when prices of everything are going through the roof. Above all, gasoline, $9 a gallon, a year of college tuition, $83,000. You described the standard of living palpably, viscerally shrunken.
Well, for most people, and this this scenario, which again I'll distinguish from the Iraq one, and that I was trying to carefully report what experts thought would happen.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, I actually carefully reported what experts thought might happen if we didn't sort of change our current ways. But all those figures you just read are essentially just extrapolations of the situation now. The income distribution has becoming more unequal in the last decade. If it became, the same thing happened for the next decade, you'd have a situation where essentially 10 to 12% of the population would be better off in real terms. Everybody else would be significantly worse. Just by current trends, college would cost $80,000 plus a year a decade from now, much more than the median income. So that's the road we are headed down.
You've got National Guard medical units staffing local hospitals because they've laid off doctors and nurses. You've got America's airline companies all announcing quicker than the government can regulate that they're merging into one. They're cutting 150 cities off of their flight schedules. They're cutting a third of their staff back. I mean, just everywhere you turn in this 2016 picture, it's a tighter, grayer, diminished, more second world country we're talking about.
Well, of course, you're leaving out all the comic elements of the story too, which, and so I don't mean to chortle at these scenes of dismay, but with the airlines again, if you think of General Motors and Ford have been losing money on every single car in recent years. Similarly, the airlines recently, the major airlines, have been losing money on every single passenger. So it doesn't take much extrapolation from that and a continued ramping up in the cost of energy and cost of security just to have them think, well, the only way we can survive is I have a secret meeting for them one night at the DFW Hilton where the remaining airlines announced the federal government, we're all joining, and if you don't like it, we're all declaring bankruptcy at the same time together.
And you've got this going on in the briefing of a new third-party candidate who's got pretty much a lock on winning. He's got a lock, his advisor tells him, because the country has learned that Democrats can't win and Republicans cannot govern. How does he figure out that?
Well, the advisor admits that's a somewhat too bold statement, but then the nuanced version is even worse. Because the nuanced version is the Democrats can't win unless everything happens to break their way. And the advisor points out that since Lyndon Johnson left the White House, the three Democrats to have won are Jimmy Carter, who got to run against the only appointed president in American history and against the ghost of Richard Nixon,
mm-hmm.
Bill Clinton, who for all his talents would have lost if Ross Perot hadn't stayed in the race,
mm-hmm.
and the successor to George W. Bush, the preacher, who gets to come in for unusual circumstances described in the article involving Fidel Castro. So unless there is a fluke, the Democrats don't win, and the Republicans, every single one of them, starting in Richard Nixon, the point is they can't govern without breaking the bank. The dollar is always lower, the trade deficit is always higher, the manufacturing base is always smaller after a Republican leaves office than when he took place. So what's the choice for the public?
So the public, under severe distress, turns to an independent candidate. It turns out to be, you're vague about who it is, a kind of technology background. So one wonders who follows a war hero that didn't work out but ends up being the first African-American president. Let's roll back the tape for a minute here because you go through the sequence. This is, again, an advisor, the Karl Rove type telling the president how to see these last years. And you describe three big phases sort of between now and 2016. You call them cocking the gun, pulling the trigger, and bleeding. I wish you'd give us a summary of each of those phases that led to this horrible pass you've envisioned.
Well, the cocking the gun moment is essentially what we're living through right now. And the point here, this is all using actual evidence from the world of the early 2000s,
mm-hmm.
is that the fundamental economic calculus, both of the country as a whole and also the federal government, has gone sort of wildly off its accustomed point. The memo starts out saying that, yes, the world did change in 2001, but it wasn't all on September 11th. The pivotal day was really a day in June, which I describe, when the stock market reached its historic peak, and when the government locked in a lower tax, lower revenue level than it had, you know, for decades. And so at a time when all kinds of demands in the government were going up, the sources of government revenue were going down, and that imbalance was solved only by the Chinese, who kept, you know, shipping us money for our treasury bonds as we kept shipping them jobs. And so you had this kind of the building up pressure of pressure on energy supplies, housing bubble, the dollar being overvalued because the Chinese won't change, and suddenly something has to give. That's the cocking the trigger phase of current life.
So that kind of cocking the gun, and as that's cocked, we see that the American obligations abroad remain very deep. In 2016, there's still 100,000 troops or more, not just in Iraq, but by that point they've also been sent into action in Pakistan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, the border between Turkey and the Republic of Kurdistan, suggesting a breakup in Iraq. So we've got the gun cocked, America deep in debt, the Chinese holding a huge amount of that debt, then comes pulling the trigger. How does that happen in your scenario?
What happens is that the thing which sort of gets everything moving, you know, we're all familiar with these cliches now of the butterfly flapping his wings and the whole weather system changing.
Right.
The butterfly in this case is our own beloved Fidel Castro, who happens to die right before the 2008 election. And that starts a number of dominoes. You know, the Cuban Americans in Florida who had been so loyally Republican aren't, you know, motivated in the same way as before. There's some problems assimilating the Cuba Libre influx of people from Cuba. The Democrats come in, but as a result of the upheaval in Cuba, there's also upheaval in Venezuela. The dictator of Venezuela manages to disrupt the world oil supply, and suddenly, just as Jimmy Carter long ago was overtaken by events,
right,
the victorious Democrat, the preacher, suddenly finds things falling in all around him.
Now, you call him the preacher because before 2008, he embraced the Republican kind of appeal to the moral values of America whole hog and won along with this Fidel Castro wave, and then Hugo Chavez in Venezuela kind of cutting a backroom deal with China about oil supplies, leaving the U.S. high and dry. When the trigger gets pulled, what are the consequences for the U.S.?
The main way, the first consequence essentially is the run on the dollar, where as I think Americans know vaguely, but it doesn't really kick in. You know, if you've been to Europe, you know how much the dollar has fallen against the euro, except in the last month or two.
Yeah.
Over the last 2 years, it's lost significant value. It's lost no value against the Chinese yuan, which is pegged to it, even though there's this huge trade imbalance between China and the U.S. Suddenly, the sort of ripple effects through the world economy of the oil shock triggered the run on the dollar, which the main effect on that, as the dollar loses about half its value against the yuan, is on interest rates in America. And interest rates have been so low for so long, we've forgotten how unpleasant it is when they go up. But when they go up, basically everything we care about goes down. Housing prices, the stock market, bond prices, economic activity, and that's the trigger for things going bad.
And things do go bad. It's a kind of domino effect which leads to that third stage, which we've really talked about, bleeding, when the United States is just a diminished country. A couple of things come to mind. First of all, I mean, I'm struck by how we see these storm clouds every day. What you're kind of suggesting here is that we've become too accustomed to them, that we're not taking seriously enough the possibility of them lining up in a real devastating storm.
Well, you know, there is the economic cliche that things that can't go on forever don't. And one way or another, all the different imbalances, for example, the fact that Americans essentially save no money these days. Our savings rate now is the lowest in sort of recorded history, and that you can't sustain that and also trying to invest. You can't have the kind of energy imbalance we have. You can't have the currency imbalances. So one way or another, these things will stop. There has been an assumption, I think, that, you know, one way that somehow they'll adjust themselves in a smooth and convenient fashion. But economic history involves some so-called hard landings, too, and this is the hard landing scenario.
You say, in retrospect, the ugly end is so obvious and inevitable. Why didn't people see it at the time? I mean, you're not cheering for this outcome. On the contrary, James Fallows, you're saying, watch out, stand up, change course.
Yes. Again, I think that if there's anything I hope from people reading the article is, first, I hope they will find it interesting. It's meant to be an interesting
read. It absolutely is.
And it's meant to convey a number of of views of the actual situation on the ground, if you will, right now. And I should say that I spent about 6 weeks before writing this just interviewing economists and tech people and airline executive people and car executive people, trying to say what would happen if the course didn't change. But then I hope that it would at least inform some current sense of, gee, maybe we should change something about the trade policy or the energy policy or the deficit policy, or not refinance that house on an interest-only loan.
Or you may end up in one of those RVs, the shantytown on wheels somewhere in an army base in America. We're talking tonight about an imagined vision of America in 2016, when oil, the dollar, the deficit, jobs, interest rates have all gone horribly and all too realistically wrong. My guest is James Fallows with the Atlantic Monthly. His coming piece is Countdown to a Meltdown. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. Ed is calling from Boston. Hi, Ed. What do you think?
How you doing? I think that, there might be some truth to it, but I think as long as this country has the intellectual resources that it has, that we will change course. I just think this country needs a wake-up call. You know, it's bad times have happened to this country in the past, and we've always recovered. And as long as we have those intellectual resources, they'll be able to stop the bleeding. We might cock the gun, we might pull the trigger, but I think we'll be able to stop the bleeding. And if, like the old adage, if you owe the bank a dollar, the bank owns you, but if you owe the bank a million, you own the bank. So I think the fact that we have these money issues, I think they might work in our favor to some degree, because these countries might want to work with the U.S. so they can, get their money back or pay off their
investment. Yeah, Ed, I think that's terrific. I think you've really capsulized what an awful lot of people carry around in their head every day, me included, and it's comforting. And it is much of American history is exactly along those lines. But Jim Fallows, let me get your response directly
to
that.
Sure. I should say, the bottom line is I basically am an American optimist. And I think when America is sufficiently shocked, it responds in effective ways. And what I'm trying to do is to provide an intellectual shock before the actual thing happens. On the two points, one about the bank, you owning the bank or the bank owning you, I think there has been that element to the relationship with China, the idea that so much of their money is tied up in dollars they can't afford to have a run on the dollar because they'd hurt themselves too. What I'm trying to explain here is something that a number of economists said to me, which is that you could only assume that so much. There comes a certain time where, in certain circumstances, the Chinese will say, okay, this will cost us something in the short term, but we can't stand it anymore. We can't hold these dollars. We might as well unload them before somebody else unloads them on us. On the intellectual talent, I think that also is a really interesting point. I'm a big believer in America as a magnet for the world's talent, and I think one of the most damaging changes in the last 4 years has been, the closing of the visa policy for workers and for graduate students. So I think of all the vulnerabilities we've inflicted on ourselves, that narrowing the supply of intellectual talent coming in is one of the more important ones.
You write about China with a policy of 20 Harvards that I guess has already been laid out, and you describe it kind of beginning to succeed by 2016 with the sort of Harvard equivalent in Beijing and the Harvard equivalent in Bombay, in Mumbai, and the U.S. no longer the solitary beacon on that front.
Well, the program actually exists in China. If they ever give it the name I chose of 20 Harvards, they can have it with my blessings. But there is this ambition, and clearly it's harder for the Chinese, it's harder for anybody else to create soon the kind of center the U.S. has as an academic establishment. Harvard is by far the richest educational institution in the world, and there's been a 50-year tradition of the U.S. attracting talent from around the world. But every place you talk to people in higher education in the U.S. or overseas, they talk about how the terms of interaction are changing. I'll give you one anecdote. I was at a meeting this afternoon of the National Security Agency, the super secret National
NSA,
Security
right,
Agency.
Right.
And the people I talked to who are giving briefings were one person from Romania originally, one person from Greece originally, one person from Poland originally, one person from Lebanon, and another person from Romania.
That's valuable talent. Mm-hmm.
And these were people who were coming in, and they were saying, their protégés, the next generation of people like them, were not being able to come in.
Let me ask you, Jim Fallows, just about the core of what Ed's saying here, which is this kind of notion that he says, look, we can pull the trigger, but America pulls it out. And I think people do find solace in that. But I wonder, is that a mindset that leads to the wake-up? Does it make the digging out a whole lot worse? And is it right to think that the country can dig out and get back to the place that most Americans expect to be in the world economy?
Well, I guess two points. One is, yes, this country has great resources and we can survive a lot of shocks, but it sure would have been better if we didn't have to have the Great Depression. You know, we survived
Amen.
It,
yeah.
But it was 10 years of 12 years of pretty bad experience for a lot of people. And so the United States will be strong in the long run. You know, whether it will be stronger than China in the long run, we'll see. But it would be better if we didn't have to go through all that agony of the foreclosures and just, you know, people losing their jobs and all the rest, which is unpleasant and terrible and damaging. So that's point one. Of whether we have the resources, I think people who have not spent a lot of time outside the U.S. recently would be surprised by how much people outside the U.S., it's not sort of, you know, resistance to our foreign policies, but how much they think the U.S. is neglecting its fundamental strengths. You know, our roads are worse than most other countries are. Our public schools are worse than a lot of other countries are. There's a sense of inequality in the country, so there is something to be addressed here.
Talking tonight with James Fallows of the Atlantic Monthly, he's imagining America 2016, and it's not a pretty picture, one everybody would like to avoid. What's the way out of this future? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with James Fallows, national correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly. His upcoming article is Countdown to a Meltdown, America's Coming Economic Crisis, a look back imagined from the election of 2016. You can join the conversation. Can you imagine waking up 11 years from now in a second-class nation and America on the ropes, a has-been? And what kind of leadership does the country need to dodge this bullet? Is the country ready to pull up its socks and change its future? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Chris is calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Chris, you're on the air.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Boy, what a fascinating article. I think this is exactly what's needed. I think we need a wake-up call.
To picture it.
I mean, in this graphic detail,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I appreciate that he's taken the risk to go ahead and put some specifics on
mm-hmm.
it. It's easy to talk in generalities. I think our worship as a society, our worship of individualism and self-sufficiency has morphed into a selfishness, and I think we've lost all sense of limits, and I think that's a lot of our problem. Ancient cultures valued stability over growth as an economic thing.
But right now, Chris, China and India are all about growth. They're growing like gangbusters, and James Fallows suggests potentially growing right past us.
Yeah, but in when we see that, we just tend to think that, like our friend Ed said, that we're just going to overcome that. We always mm-hmm. have in the past, and I think that's a hubris that is leading us down this road.
But do you think that Americans would be willing to settle to say, growth is overrated, let's settle down, read the classics, and, you know, be a kind of a less affluent nation? I don't know, along the lines of Portugal or something.
About the biggest paradigm shift I can imagine, but it's one that is inevitable, and it'll either come about voluntarily or it will come about by the situation that develops.
Well, I wonder if it's inevitable. Chris, thanks very much for your call, though. James Fallows, can you imagine Americans coming to terms with this? I mean, first of all, psychologically, and secondly, the social dynamic. You quote Daniel Patrick Moynihan in here about what America needs to hang together as a nation.
Indeed, I quote my imagined advisor says this is a story that his father told him. This was my own personal experience. This is a speech I heard myself by Daniel Patrick Moynihan in the late 1960s when he was saying that part of the promise of America has always been a sense of mobility and opportunity different from Europe's. And he said that in European novels, you read about people, young people waiting for old people to die. So there's opportunity opens up. Whereas in, you know, the American standard novel is somebody inventing a new opportunity. And I think for the United States, that sense of opportunity is a very important part of our glue. Since we lack the glue that holds a lot of other societies together, you know, we're not all one people like the Japanese, or all one language, or whatever. So I think the loss of that sense of possibility and equality is more of a blow to us than it is to most other societies, and that's why it's important to keep it alive.
And Moynihan's fear, if we lost that, what was the fear that he held?
Fear was that the sort of social bargain of the United States would not survive its becoming a stagnant, permanently unfair place. And I think that's the significance of a lot of big newspaper series we've read in the last 6 months in the major papers about evidence of the U.S. becoming both more unequal and more rigid and more in its income distribution, because that is something you would expect of, you know, Bourbon France or something, but mm-hmm. but the American idea that we tolerate unfairness because we think that everybody has an opportunity to redress it. If we think people don't have those opportunities, then the social compact doesn't hold.
You say there's always been class, even racial caste at times, but the myth had enough truth to it to hold the country together. Without that, not so sure. Mark is calling from McHenry, Illinois. Hi, Mark, you're on the air.
Good evening, and I look forward to reading this article very much. And I, you know, the point that that Mr. Fellows just made is what troubles me the most, because given the sort of situation that we're looking at, I have sincere concerns about what kind of a society this will be if these events take place from the level of social disarray and fractioning. It concerns me a great deal, and frankly. My direct point was that I don't know how we're going to avoid this, because we certainly don't have the leadership now that either is aware of these trends coming or just doesn't want to believe them. I don't see historically in the so-called leadership class in this country, those people who are constantly being voted into office, any sense of true common sense, of any sense of looking at the, you know, dogma on the left, dogma on the right doesn't solve problems, it creates problems. What we need is common sense and wisdom, and people like that generally get called moderates and are diminished and marginalized in our political system. I hope these events don't come to pass, but I frankly don't see any sort of leadership now or coming up the pike that is going to turn the tide.
You don't hear that cavalry coming over the... over the horizon there. Mark, thanks for that. James Fellows, how about it? You write about ending up here not with the cavalry coming from Republicans or Democrats, but from an independent.
Right. And you know, here's an example of the kind of common sense thing that I think we could do to redress the course. And I may say this not as a partisan comment, although the issue I'm going to address has been a partisan one, but whether or not the Congress decides to make permanent, you know, the elimination of, call it the death tax, call it the estate tax, call it what you want, that's going to represent somewhere between an $800 billion and $1 trillion swing in public revenues over the next decade or so. And we have in this memo somebody saying, gee, what we could do if we had that $1 trillion back. Think we could make our railroads as good as the ones in China. We could do something about our schools. We could make our aerospace industry competitive with Europe's again. So we have a choice coming up essentially on a very, very large chunk of public money, which you know, we will give back to the upper 2 or 3% of the income distribution, or we won't. But that's the kind of decision that still lies ahead of us.
But how do you picture the profile of the leader who emerges that's not a Republican or a Democrat? Is he, as our caller in McHenry describes, a pragmatist, a common sense guy? Who's the winner?
The profile that's hinted at in this article is that he's like Dwight Eisenhower, but from the technology industry. Somebody who the nation turns to because they think this is a person who can save them with his competence.
Is this Bill Gates, Steve Ballmer? Is this?
I was rising above mere specific personality, because as soon as you name a specific person, you can think, oh no, not that guy.
Right.
But somebody who would be
a type there.
The technology, the Eisenhower of technology.
And can you really feel that in your bones? You're a political animal. Can you see that kind of player? The country coming around to that would be a different pond to draw from.
I can see, I feel something different from what I've ever felt before in my depressingly long political life, which is I can imagine another election or two, a third party making it. If people just feel the two established parties, been around since before the Civil War, that neither of them can deal with the actual issues that face the country. So this this article proposes that in the third election from now, the third party will win, and I actually could imagine that happening.
I've got to say, just as an aside, you've got this terrific story of the 2012 election, which is won by a war hero, the nation turning to a war hero in desperation, and not just any war hero, but the man, the four-star general, who leads Desert Eagle. I guess that's his name. It leads an operation just before Christmas 2011 that surrounds, captures, and gags Osama bin Laden in the middle of the night. He comes back a war hero and America's first black president in 2012.
Political insiders always thought it would be a black Republican, that a Republican would be America's first black president. They just thought it would be Colin Powell.
Right. Raju is calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Raju, you're on the air.
Thank you. I read the article. I thought it was a wonderful article, and I also appreciate your comments. One thing I wanted to ask is, what do you think about the competition? You know, your article assumes that the United States faces a great deal of competition, but these competitive nations, for example, China and even India as well as Europe, do face their own problems. And as debtor nations, they also face problems internally because they are not democracies. In many cases, for example, China, and also they have problems with energy and with their own infrastructure to build an economy. And I think they're still not able to lure the top minds in their own countries who actually still want to go to places like Boston, to MIT, and places like that to grow and to become prosperous. And I think the competition is still coming to the United States, and I think the competition still has problems. And
Raju, we've got it, and you raise an important point there, Jim Fallows. How about it? A, are you overstating the competitor's kind of stature? And B, you're assembling all the possible downside here for the United States, but what about the downside of China or India? Might our bacon be saved by them stumbling?
Well, I agree with everything a caller is saying about the vulnerabilities of China and India. And certainly over the next 20 years, if you wanted to have a country's problems, you probably would choose America's problems because they are more easily correctable than, say, China's. But I think the fact that they have limitations doesn't necessarily make things that much better for us. For example, it's precisely because China has so many people thronging into the cities in need of work for domestic stability in China that they've been keeping the value of the yuan so low and having this export machine to the U.S. And so the fact that they are struggling isn't necessarily that good for the U.S.
So don't look to that for the life preserver, but still, we take the point. Stan's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Stan, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. My question has to do with all of these consequences that Mr. Fallows is forecasting, the loss of opportunity and potentially the loss of social cohesiveness. How likely is it that this country can stay together as a nation? You know, we fought a civil war in the 19th century over a difference of social policy, and Lincoln tried to keep the nation together. But as regions, the Pacific Northwest, New England, start to feel that they have less common cause with other parts of the country, especially the South, how likely it is that can we stay together as a country?
And Stan, is it really physical breakup that comes to mind for you?
I shudder to even think of the consequence. I remember a few years ago there were several academics in the Pacific Northwest who were actively discussing that maybe there is a country created out of Northwest states and maybe Canadian Northwest provinces.
Got
called
it.
Cascadia.
And off they go. Civil war, that would be a distraction. James Fallows, you don't suggest in your little shop of horrors secession.
Right. And I guess I personally don't worry that much about, you know, the literal cohesion of the United States. I can tell you, again, speaking very honestly, there are two experiences in my life that encapsulate what I worry about. One is the way New York was in the late 1970s, in New York City I'm talking about, where all the finances were in shambles. That was when there was a famous headline, you know, Ford to New York dropped dead. And there was this sense just of descent into kind of Hobbesian, everybody surviving at the expense of everybody else. Everything was run down. Everybody was on edge. Everybody was against everybody else. Similarly, I spent, as you did too, Tom, a fair amount of time in the Philippines during the 1980s, and the sense of a very unequal society where people are, they can't afford to be generous to each other because everybody is so much, so much suspicious of each other and so much up in arms against each other. That is the, that's the true nightmare scenario from my point of view, not another civil war.
I wonder, you write about the jobless recovery of the early 2000s, that we all know, but then you write about a jobless collapse at the end of that decade. What's the shape of that in your envisioned scenario?
I think we have, you know, two unfortunate straws in the wind with the news over the last month about airlines continuing to shed jobs, and of course the General Motors news of today. If some of the major sources of large-scale manufacturing employment continue to struggle, as has been the case, and you have the hit of interest rates, which will, you know, the construction industry suddenly would come to a halt, and the house renovation industry, and the car industry, and the durable goods industry, and a number of big exporters. If the aircraft industry, if Boeing continues to struggle against Airbus, if all those things happen, you know, you have you just have continued shedding of these jobs. So it's been, if no jobs are created when the economy is growing, it's going to be worse if the economy is shrinking.
Let's get one more call here. Lynn's calling from Cranston, Rhode Island. Hi, Lynn, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I'm listening to you speak of these events and things with perspective off in the distance.
Yeah, 2016 is the
conceit.
I'd
really like to call your attention to the fact that so many people, a large segment of the population, this is now, you know, housing is
unaffordable, the job's not there.
You know, health issues are problems. Housing may not be there in days. Housing is not already there for many people. You have to be, I think, of a certain economic level to be able to have that kind of comfortable perspective.
Where you push it 11 years out. Lynn, our time is short, but thanks for reminding us of that. Jim Fallows, how do you see that? Is some of the country already in the python here?
I'm not at all meaning to sound smug about this. On the contrary, I'm saying that if the country, at a time when interest rates are low, when there's not an economic shock, has all the problems we do now, what about when the shock comes?
Jim, our time grows short here, but I just want to ask you how you feel about the momentum of the country right now. Is this the memo that you really imagine being? I mean, I know you're doing this for dramatic effect, but is this the arc we're on? Is this where we're headed without significant change now?
It's where we're headed without significant change. I guess the hopeful part of me that has seen America come back from its Vietnam War struggles and from its late 80s struggles imagines that before 2016, we will change course, but it requires a change, which is not in evidence at the moment.
And do you feel it in the air? Do you feel it in the conversation? Do you feel it in the way Americans imagine or perceive the future before reading this piece?
Not yet. I guess I would feel better if any politician of any party was talking about the possibility of serious economic problem. You know, if we have the main economic debate of the last 3 or 4 months has been this Social Security problem of 40 or 50 years from now, which makes me just hold my head, how about a comparable effort to the problem of the next year or two?
Well, I pray that we're not having you back in 2016 and saying how right you were.
Well, I appreciate giving the chance to have this warning now.
Yeah, we appreciate your bringing it to us. James Fallows is national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. His article in the July-August issue is Countdown to a Meltdown. Jim Fallows, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Jim Fallows, his article about the consequences of victory in Iraq, the 51st state, won the 2003 National Magazine Award. Listeners, you can continue this conversation at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Michael Garth, Marika Bukas, Yo Tom Barkai, and Angel Cozzelli. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.